Hello and welcome back to episode 5 of the Panic Room podcast. Today I have another two-parter for you and I'm joined again by Jay. This is the story of the Amityville Horror House, also known as the Amityville Horror Story. This is going to be in two parts because in this episode I'm going to be covering the true crime case that actually happened in the house and the story that led to the now ever famous Amityville Horror Story that we all know in popular media today. So that's what we've got to look forward to. Before I play the main audio, I just want to address, I understand the audio for the past few episodes has been a little bit sketchy. I have got a new mic set up and it's just been a case of toying with different settings and trying to get both mics to sound relatively the same, even though they're both two completely different types of mics. So yeah, the audio in this episode and the next one is not the best, but I promise you by the next episode that I'm going to upload with Elliot, that should all be hopefully sorted out, but for now this is how it's going to sound. I do apologize, bear with me. And yeah, I don't think I've got anything more I really want to say about this case. I think it's pretty well known anyway, but hope you guys enjoy and welcome to episode 5 of the Panic Room. Welcome to the Panic Room, where all your darkest fears are gonna come for you. Hello and welcome back to the Panic Room podcast. Today I'm joined by Jay.
Again.
She's hello. Back. You're back for another case.
With a better mic.
Yeah, you're the first person to actually experience the new setup.
Yes.
Elliot was recording with me a few days ago, but that's the first time he's recorded. So you've seen the glow up of the studio today.
The studio, i.e. the kitchen table.
My mammy's kitchen table. But yeah, so we're back. This week I've been doing a lot of recording and a lot of research. I've been kind of backing up my recording files just so they're there to upload whenever. I'm currently researching the whole Jeffrey Epstein case and all that.
That's a good one.
But I've got a lot I want to cover in that. I'm probably going to do it in, I'm assuming, more than two or three parts just because there's so much to cover. So that's going to be a little while longer, but it's going to be worth the wait. So at first I just wanted to do a kind of fun mini episode with you. Ooh. And I originally wanted to do, so I don't know if you know what Shudder is.
Is that the, like, horror?
Yeah, it's like a Netflix, but it's like all horror
Elliot
films.
Has it, he said it was shite.
Yeah, but they've brought out like a documentary and it's basically about different horror movie sets that are haunted.
Oh, right, okay.
And like cursed films and that whole sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. So I started researching that and then I got to this topic and I just kind of fell down a hole. So now we're doing a full episode just on this one. So it is really good. So today we're going to be talking about the Amityville murders, also known as the Amityville Horror Story.
Ooh, I always thought it was Amityville, but then again,
so
I just can't
but,
spell.
It's, well, when the documentaries I was listening to, they pronounced it as Amityville. Well, they call it Amityville? No.
But they'll be like Amityville.
Yeah, like so. I'm going to call it Amityville because accents and that. So this is going to be a two-parter. The actual murders is a true crime case.
Yes.
But the Amityville horror story is like a paranormal sort of ghost story thing.
I kind of vaguely like know. I know there's a movie. Never seen it because I'm an actual like pussy. I fucking hate horror
See,
movies.
I love horror movies. No one will watch them with me, but it's really
Elliot,
sad.
Oh, he's up here weirdo. He sits by himself and watches horror movies.
Yeah, he does. He's really into his horror. He also reads a lot of horror books as well, which not my cup of tea, but. But yeah, so this part one that you're listening to, this is strictly going to be on the actual true crime case that happened in the house.
Okay.
And then we're going to get moved on to more of the kind of paranormal and like folklore behind the house itself and how that came about. Because it is like a cult classic now. Mm. It's known as like this really famous. Jay doesn't know how to act with this now, mate.
It's funny. I keep going.
But
it's pure ASMR.
ASMR tingle. I could be really good at ASMR.
Yeah.
ASMR. Maybe we should just record the full episode in whispers.
I think that would get us a lot of lessons.
No, we're not doing that. Maybe next time. So, this case took place in a house at 112 Ocean Drive. Sorry, Ocean Avenue. And it was 30 miles outside New York in the city of Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard of the Long Island iced tea. That's a cocktail, but apparently Long Island is a really nice kind of suburban area in the outskirts of New York. A lot of rich, affluent families live there. And this whole case follows the case of the, I'm going to try and say his name right, the DeFeo family. So the whole time I was researching this case, in my head I was reading it as Defoe. And then I started watching documentaries and it's actually DeFeo. So I'm just going to announce it now. I'll probably end up chopping and changing between the two.
But it is the DeFeo family, that's how you pronounce DeFeo. It, but I might end up saying DeFeo.
It's quite nice, DeFeo.
So this, particularly Ronald DeFeo, he was the oldest son, and on Wednesday, November the 13th, 1974, he murdered his entire family in the Amityville house while they're all sleeping in their beds.
Wow.
So that's where we're going with this. So that's the crux of the story. As I said, the horrors and the kind of events that happened in the house have occurred inspiration for best-selling books and also the movie adaptation, The Amityville Horror. And countless TV shows and remakes have been made of this full story. So it's very much been capitalised on Hollywood and that whole thing.
Which is kind of sad because it's people's lives.
Yeah, when you think about it, it's like a really sad travesty that happened and people are... Particularly when we get onto George and Kathy Lutz, they basically took... I think they took it and run with it, but there's debate over that as well, whether they made it up for publicity or whether they were just, I don't know, seeing things, but... Yeah.
Or weird.
So the house itself is said to be haunted and it's drawn many paranormal experiences from people, a lot of which actually occurred filming both the original 1979 film and the remake in 2005, and we'll get onto that because that's how I fell down this hole when I was researching the sets. So let's just get into the case. Just to give a little intro, I just want to kind of lay the grounds here because maybe I'm just really dumb, but I was getting a bit confused when I was researching it at the start. So this story I'm about to tell you, this happened. This was real. Okay?
Okay.
When we move on to the later reports of like the hauntings and the movie adaptations and George and Kathy Lutz's story, that's where the whole debate comes about the house being haunted.
Yeah.
But right now we're strictly talking about
an actual
true crime case.
Yes.
So, yeah. Right. So before we get into the murders, we're just going to rewind a bit. Give you a little background about the family and the house. So the house itself was built in 1924 by George and Catherine Monaghan. They built it themselves, so it was kind of like their dream home. They always wanted to live here. They reportedly lived in the house for many years, very happy, nothing out of the ordinary, never experienced anything evil or paranormal. It was kind of hard to find a lot about them in the house before the DeFeo family moved in, just because of the time period. It was the 1920s. And there wasn't a lot of public records on them. However, I did find a report of a man who died in the house in 1939 after an illness. So I'm going to go on a limb here and say that was probably John Monaghan.
Right, yeah.
But regardless, there was nothing strange or, you know, weird about his death. He just died of a natural illness. And the couple eventually both passed away and the house was left to their family members. Right, so it was in the ownership of either their son or their daughter or whoever. In 1965, the descendants of the Monaghans sold the home to the DeFeos. Almost said DeFeo there. So they bought it in 1965. Okay. This family, the DeFeos, were reportedly a very seemingly happy and quite well-off family who had Italian roots. They moved from Brooklyn to Long Island just for a new start. They wanted to get away from...
That door is going to... It's the window.
Probably not the best.
You also have mad things hanging off your... door handles.
They rattle. Fun story, when I was researching this, I was up to about 3 a.m. in my house. It's like, it's not a really old house, but I think it was built in like the 1950s, I want to say. And it creaks a lot, and sometimes I hear, like, have you ever heard the same phantom footsteps?
Yes,
because of the floorboards and my stairs creak so much. And obviously my desk is like right next to my bedroom window. And now my neighbours are just out having a conversation. We've had the worst time trying to record this.
Fucking bastard.
Some guy was out cutting his grass and then he would stop every 10 minutes and I'd be like, oh, he's away, we can record. And then start again. And now someone's just having... I'm reluctant to close the windows, but it'll get really hot in here.
Well, I've got a blanket on, but it's up to you.
I'll close them. Just because we're going to get very spooked, I feel, whilst talking about murder.
Yeah, shit myself.
They were a big family. Mother and father, Ronald and Louise. Ronald was also known as Big Ronnie. I'm going to refer to him as Big Ronnie for the rest of the case, only because him and the son have the same name. The son was Ronald Jr., but I'm just going to call him Big Ronnie, just so we can differentiate between the two.
Big Ronnie's the dad.
Big Ronnie's the dad, and regular Ronald, or just Ronald. Regular Ronald. He's the son. So they had 5 children, as I said. Ronald, he was 23 at the time of the murders. Dawn, who was 18. Alison was 13. Mark was 12, and John Matthew, who was only 9, which is really sad, because obviously we know that he dies.
His whole life.
I know, so sad. So Big Ronnie was a car dealer's like service manager. I couldn't find out what Louise done, but I know she did pursue some sort of a modelling career in her youth.
Ooh.
But I think she might have just been like a stay-at-home mum.
Yeah.
When it came to like the kids and stuff.
Like a failed model.
Yeah. Well, yeah, failed model. And he worked in the same car dealership. So her dad owned a car dealership, so it was kind of like a family business.
Mm-hmm.
And he worked there with his father-in-law. As I said, the family reportedly lived a really comfortable life in Amityville, despite not being that well off, because the dad wasn't... He worked in a car dealership, but he was in no way, like, you know, rich. But the father-in-law, I think, had a lot to do with helping them out financially.
Yeah.
Apparently, he spent 50 grand on a series of life-size portraits for the family at one point. Which is ridiculous. Yeah, 50
Why?
Grand. I don't know.
Who needs them? And who would spend 50, that amount of money on shite?
Like shite to hang in your living room. But he paid for that, so I think he helped out a lot with the family's expensive lifestyle, shall we say.
Wow.
However, the home life was not all sunshine and roses, as most more often than not in these cases, it never is. There's always something going on behind closed doors. It was mainly Big Ronnie. He was said to be a very harsh character. We'll put it lightly, he definitely didn't treat his wife or his children in the way that he should have. Grown up, it was Ronald Defoe, the eldest, or Defoe, who had the hardest kind of...
That's a shame.
...from his dad. He was pretty much the main source of, like, his dad's abusiveness. He fought with the mum, and I'm sure the rest of the children all received it, but it was mainly Ronald who got it.
That's a shame.
This was apparently because he was a firstborn and a boy. His father expected a lot from him, and I think he wasn't really shy in punishing him if he stepped out of line or didn't act it. I know it's disgusting. And honestly, like, we're seeing it in all these cases. The one that I talked with, Elliot, as well. Again, another really abusive, domineering parent, and they never turn out well. So maybe just look after your kids. But, So Big Ronnie was not afraid to discipline Little Ronnie.
Little Ronnie.
Wee Ronnie. Apparently he was just really hot and cold with him. So like one minute he'd be really like hugging him and being very loving towards him. And then the next minute he'd be like literally throwing him about the room. So I'm going to say there was some sort of misplaced anger issues there, because it was very much one minute.
And then the next minute.
Yeah, and the next minute he just like flipped and...
That's so weird.
Yeah.
How people can just do that? Like, Mahmood does not change that fast. Like,
no. And even at that, it's like, you can be happy one minute and then be like, oh, I'm having a shit time. But to go from one extreme to, like, violent outbreaks, there must have been something going on up there. Not right. Louise's brother, Michael, during the court trial, testifies about an incident when he witnessed Big Ronnie basically hitting Little Ronnie. This is when he was 2 years old. He said basically they're all sitting down in the basement watching TV, and he didn't know what, but Ronald had done something, and then all of a sudden his father just stood up and pushed him like into a wall, and the boy like banged his head and part of his shoulder at 2 years old as well. Like, what are you doing putting your hands... What is a 2 year old doing that's so bad that you're feeling to put your hands on them? It's a 2 year old.
I know.
Like, there's no... there's no justification towards it. I know some people choose to discipline their kids in certain ways, but a 2 year old baby,
not like,
there's just no reason
that's
for that.
Not right.
No, it's disgusting.
Don't know any better.
Exactly, they're literally just babies. Like, I don't understand. So clearly he wasn't afraid to hit his children, even more so he wasn't afraid to do it in front of company. So you can only imagine how worse it would be behind closed doors. That's how he's acting in front of his brother-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
Can only imagine how much worse it was when there was no one around. And apparently, as I said, Big Ronnie and Louise's relationship wasn't the best. They were always fighting, constantly arguing. Just a really toxic household.
Yeah. Doesn't
not the best.
Great.
She tried to leave him at one point when Ronald was younger. This is before the other kids were born.
Oh, I can imagine how that went down.
Yeah. He eventually chased her down and convinced her to stay with him.
Yeah.
And on July the 29th, 1956, Louise gave birth to her daughter Dawn. A few years later, on August 16th, 1961, Louise gave birth to Alison, and then again on September the 4th, 1962, to Mark. So, all quite close births. The couple's fifth and final child, John Matthew, was born on October the 24th, and it was round about that time that the family decided they were going to move from their little apartment in Brooklyn to their house in Amityville, because they had a big family now.
At long last.
At long last, I'm moving.
Kill all men, like, 2020.
Yeah, Louise should have left his ass back in whenever and just started her new life, started her modelling career, you know, you don't need a man. But yeah, so moving on to Ronald now. He was the oldest, not the best childhood, as we've kind of established. Not only from his father, but apparently he experienced a lot of bullying growing up. He was very overweight as a child, and that was something that he got relentlessly picked on in school, which that's really sad. That's going to knock anyone's confidence, especially if you're at such a young age. I do feel bad for him on that front. But it was when he matured, kind of around about his teenage years, he began to lash out physically against his father. So basically, he was like getting a bit stronger, didn't really need to take his father's shit anymore, and decided that he was going to...
I hope he fucking knocked him about.
Like... So, yeah. Apparently, as well, he'd done this with a lot of his friends. He became quite domineering in his friend groups, which I'm just going to assume is him trying to gain some sort of power back in his life. Obviously, he's been bullied by his dad and kids at school.
Mm-hmm.
Now he's got a bit older, he's a bit stronger, he's feeling like he can take on the world, essentially, and he's lashing out.
Sad.
So he just had a lot of misplaced anger as young teenage boys. All this kind of built up emotions, he'd be lashing out, which I don't think is that uncommon at that age. You do get some boys when they turn into their teenage years.
Chaos.
Going out fighting, like stuff like that. And for someone that's been abused and taunted for most of his life, I don't think it's a unjustified reaction. However, the family is at fault here, I think, for not keeping it in check and letting it get as far as it did.
Yeah.
So the family were obviously really concerned about his violent tendencies. He was getting reports coming back. Stop burping.
Sorry. It says tea. This is weird, not chamomile tea.
Wait, start again. So, this really concerned the family. He was lashing out, reports of school at fighting, and they took him to a psychiatrist. He didn't like this idea at all. He basically refused to go. He denied that he needed any help. He was like, nope, I'm fine.
Mm-hmm.
I think he went to a few visits. They managed to get him to go to a few, but eventually they just stopped. He just refused to go. And I think at this point he was a bit out of control. They didn't really know what to do with him.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of, you know, disciplining him and laying down the law, they decided that as a sort of incentive to get him to behave, the family would just give Ronald cash and presents to try and get him behave. So
it's kind of
not the best idea.
No.
They were essentially just throwing money at him in hopes that he would behave.
That's just like rewarding like
bad behaviour. Yeah, like and these guys, see, when I say money, it wasn't like, oh, £20 pocket money. One of the gifts that he got was a £14,000 speedboat.
How rich was this family?
See, I don't know, because the mum and dad, but I know the grandfather was very rich.
Car salesman?
Yeah, but the grandfather was really rich, and I don't know if maybe later on the father really got sales in the company, because the granddad owned this car dealership, so obviously that's all to do with sales and stuff, how many cars you sell, depends and stuff like that. But they were well off. I don't know if the family itself were well off, but they had money either from the granddad or whatever.
Honestly.
There was somewhat rumors, because obviously they're Italian descent and the time period.
Ooh.
There was kind of mob, like mobster, rumors going around. But I don't think anything really came of that. I think they were just she was from a rich family, and the granddad wanted to help out.
A speedboat for like.
Yeah, and I don't know what age he was at this time, but what are you going to do for a speedboat? Granted, they lived near a lake, but
I'd rather a yacht.
Nice for some, eh?
I know.
But,
I might start knocking lumps at my mom and see if she gives me any money.
I think you'd just get kicked at the head. You know, you can try.
No, I haven't.
So, surprise, the gifts didn't work. And by 17, Ronald had become an avid LSD and heroin user.
Jeez, what? This went from zero to like 100.
It really did. And shortly after this, he was expelled from school for his violent outbursts. So,
and being a crackhead. That is crackhead.
LSD
energy.
And heroin. Like, probably two of the most.
What?
Like, heroin's a really hard drug, and LSD's like, a total, like, psychotic.
Like, so before he went to school, he was just shooting up heroin.
Yeah, well, apparently he was just, like, taking, like, LSD and heroin, like, while he was going to school. Just. And obviously the parents must have known.
And I thought I was, like, purely, like, bad, like, smoking joints at lunch.
And he's tripping out his nut on LSD. So, yeah, so at this point, he's dependent on drugs. He's got no job, doesn't go to school. But the family, of course, decided to save the day and support their son and kind of get him back on his feet. So, where did he get a job? his grandfather's car dealership. So now he's working with his dad and his granddad.
Well done for being a crackhead. Here's a job handed to you. Yeah,
literally.
My God.
Not only that, but he still received, it was like a sort of monthly allowance from his father. So they were giving him, as well as his work wages, they were letting him stay in the house. And he was, on top of that, he was getting like a monthly allowance. I don't know how much it was, but yeah. So basically, he's in this pattern where he's getting rewarded for all his bad behaviour. Like, oh, you take drugs, you get expelled from school, here's a job, here's a monthly allowance.
Jesus.
Also, apparently, he received this monthly allowance regardless of whether he showed up to work or perform well in his sales. He was just getting money thrown at him.
That is just not teaching you any life skills whatsoever. Like.
Not good. And I feel like a lot of times in these cases, I sit and bash the parents, but there's a knock-on effect on how you raise your children. And I'm not saying they deserve to die, and I'm not saying they're like the reason why the son killed them. But in the same breath, I feel like you could have got him help earlier on to teach him that violence is not the answer. And maybe he still would have killed people, maybe he still would have became the same, but they didn't in any way try to help him.
No.
I don't think anyway. Well, maybe in their minds they were.
Environment wasn't great either.
Yeah, so. He's grown up seeing violence and stuff like that.
So
because of this, it wasn't uncommon for him to just leave work early or even just decide to take the day off.
Mm-hmm.
So he's just a big waste of space at this point. He's not going to his job. He's just showing up when he wants
sounds
to.
Sounds like a arsehole to me.
Getting paid to sit about and just get high all the time. He does. He just sounds like a typical arsehole teenager. They also bought him his own car. And continued to allow him to live in the family home. So basically, he's a spoiled brat. He's got no responsibilities.
They probably put a fucking bow on it as well.
Yeah,
like,
they're getting. Getting all this money.
I hate those pictures.
All these presents thrown at him, and so clearly he's not going to try and buck up his ideas. He's thinking this is great. Like,
he's getting his life handed to him.
Yeah.
Oh, I get louder when I'm annoyed, and I'm like, I feel like I'm at like 60,000 like octaves right now.
That is a really frustrating. Yeah. Case, but
I'm a fucking car.
He reportedly also spent all his money on guns, alcohol, and drugs.
Guns? What is it? Well, I was like, what's he using guns for?
Well, apparently he went out hunting, but anyone that has, in these cases, anyone that has an extreme fascination with guns, it never ends well.
And killing animals. That's how it starts.
Yeah. So
kill cats and stuff.
His rocky relationship with his father at this point was only getting worse. There was this one incident. He was out on a hunting trip with some friends, and basically like an argument broke out between him and his friends, and Ronald, in a fit of rage, threatened his friend at gunpoint with a rifle, and then apparently after this just acted as if nothing happened, just went back to just hanging out with his pals and joking and laughing.
Imagine I'd done that to you.
Yeah, like I'd be like, what the fuck? I'd be like, I'm never speaking to you again. Like,
yeah, exactly.
Get away from me, you absolute freak.
Yeah, just psycho.
Yeah, but he was just like, oh, you know, nothing happened. And then later on, there was an incident where he attempted to shoot his father. So basically what happened was... So basically what happened was his mum and his dad were kind of having like a heated argument one day in the house. Yeah. And he sort of got in the middle of them to kind of break it up. Mm. And then pointed his 12-gauge shotgun at his father's face. He actually pulled the trigger during this. He pulled it. But the gun malfunctioned and failed to fire. I would say that dad should thank his lucky stars, but he ended up dead anyway. But in that moment, you would have been like... Because, like, he
like
was...
the luck.
But he was fully committing to pull this point blank rage, pull this gun point blank rage.
He killed his dad.
Father's face. And the father obviously was left stunned by this confrontation, didn't really know
what to do.
Which, can't blame him.
No.
But at the same time, like, go get your son some help, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah,
just
maybe...
an idea.
Go to the police, like, my son pulled the trigger, maybe gun malfunctioned, I'm still here, but...
Like, he's trying to kill me in my house, but I couldn't find anything else.
Because
but...
he was so abusive as well, I'm still like, but... You don't kill... It's kind of a...
I don't think he deserved to die, I don't think anyone deserves to die.
No, that's what I'm trying to say,
But you can understand, but then it's like, just kill the dad. Apparently the mum was very like loving. Obviously, her and the dad had problems, but I think it was more the dad being abusive towards her, and she just kind of took it. But the mum was apparently very loving.
But I don't understand that then. Why not just kill him and then just be done with it?
Don't know, but...
But then again,
maybe
I'm
money.
Not here.
Maybe he thought that he was going to get... I mean, we'll get onto the kind of... when we later go into the actual murders, but maybe he thought he was going to be left behind the house, and his mum and dad were... Well, his grandfather was really well off. I don't
know.
I'm
going to kill my whole family and get the house. Yeah. No, you're going to the big house.
The big house must stay open. Then we got on to about a month before the actual murders took place.
Right.
So in October 1974, Ronald planned to steal money from his grandfather's car dealership. Which, before we get into it, obviously I've just brought up the fact that maybe he killed his family for money.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't understand why, because clearly his mum and his dad weren't shy about giving him money, giving all these gifts, basically bankrolling him through his full adult life.
Yeah.
So there must have been a part of him that wanted to rob money from this car dealership to get back at his family, like almost in a spite sort of way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because like when I get into it, like it was $20,000 they stole. But
big amount.
At the same time, they're spending 14 grand on a speedboat for them, so it's not as if 20 grand in the grand scheme of things for that family anyway wouldn't have been that much. But so he was basically entrusted in depositing this 20 grand into the bank for the car dealership. And basically, him and his friend kind of cooked up this plan where the friend would stage a robbery and the friend would like run off with the money, and then they would eventually meet up and split it, like that kind of deal. The plan worked, they managed to steal the money, no problems. It wasn't until the police came by to the dealership to question him that they started to suspect that he had something to do with it.
Did he crack?
Well, instead of just answering the questions calmly and very cooperatively, Ronald kicked the fuck off. Like, he went ballistic. Like,
that's not going to fucking arouse him suspicion. Yeah,
like, that's not going to make you look like you're guilty of stealing. He was just raging. He was just fucking very over-the-top reaction. The police wanted him to come down to view like mugshots to try and identify a suspect, and he was just like completely refusing to help them in the investigation or anything. I couldn't find out what actually happened. They must have ended up dropping it. But because of this, his father did start to suspect that it was Ronald that had something to do with the robbery. And when he confronted his son later on about it, Ronald threatened to kill him.
I mean,
which he ended up falling.
It's a daily occurrence now. Like. Yeah.
And this was a month before the murder, so he ended up falling through on his promise.
That's scary.
So now we got into the murders. So in the in the early hours of November the 13th, 1974, Ronald DeFeo murdered his family in their Mittyville home. Now he says he woke up at around 3:15 to complete. Claiming that voices had compelled him to kill his family.
Right, okay.
So this is where the kind of haunted vibe of the house comes from.
But he might have just been, like, schizophrenic.
Well, it's also important to mention that he later recants this.
Okay.
This was during the trial. And we'll get into that as well, but there's...
Why would you recant that, though? Because you could probably be like, oh, it was a mental health thing.
Well, I think because they ended up ruling out mental... health issues and the
court trials. I always jump.
You're fine. We'll get into it. But using a 35 caliber Marlin rifle from his secret gun stash, he entered his parents' bedroom and shot them while they both slept. Okay.
Oh,
he then goes into the brother's bedroom, shooting both of them in their beds, and then he went into his sister's and shot them point blank in their bedrooms.
Oh man.
So they were all in their beds sleeping.
Had no idea.
Boom! 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 Dead. All of these murders took place within around 50 minutes, the police estimated, which is very quick.
That is quick.
I understand that he's just going round and
it's a
detached crime. He's not stabbing them or strangling them. It's very much just point and shoot.
And I assumed that he would go for, like, in between the eyes because they were sleeping.
Well, they were all found lying on their stomachs. So,
stomachs?
Yeah.
All of them? Yes. Did they move them?
Well, we'll get into that as well.
Oh, sorry, sorry.
You're fine. These are the questions you should be asking because this whole case is... The stuff just doesn't add up. And we'll get into it. But it was also like it was a big house.
Mm-hmm.
So 15 minutes is quite a short time frame if you think about it.
Is he like fucking...
It was over the space of two floors. It was over the space of two floors as well. So at one point he was having to climb stairs, walk from one bedroom to the other... Very weird.
Done about Gordon Ramsay's cocaine before.
So he's just killed his full family in like military style fashion, and then he decides he's just going to take a shower and get dressed for work.
Who's he reporting to?
Just what? So he took his bloody clothing and the murder weapon, put them in a pillowcase, which he later dumped in a storm drain on the way to, okay, to work. So he's very much unfazed by this full murder. He's very calm and a clear mindset. He knows what he's doing. Yeah. It's calculated. And so much so that he tries to forge some sort of alibi. So this is why he went to work this day. So after he gets to work, he calls home, basically. So obviously the father hadn't showed up to work. So basically he's trying to pretend that he doesn't know why his dad didn't show up. So he's like in the office or the dealership or wherever the fuck he is, and being like, oh, did my dad not show up to work? Oh, I'll phone him and see. That's really weird. See where he is, sort of thing. So that he kind of has that sort of alibi, like, well, it couldn't be me because I was in work.
Oh, yeah, he's like, well, I don't know anything.
Yeah. So again, he's in a clear mindset. He's thinking forward. He's planning this. Meanwhile, his dad is lying dead in his bed.
Oh, that's gross.
He's a freak. But
he's a freak.
We digress. He then decided that he was bored around noon and just left work. He was like, okay, bothered. Which apparently was a regular occurrence for him.
I mean, I've done that like before, but...
Not after you've just murdered your full family, Jay.
No.
Slightly different. And then he spent the day with his friends. He tried secure an alibi with them by saying that he couldn't reach anyone at home. So he was basically with his friends like, oh, I'm not here for my mum and my dad today, weird.
Such a lying bastard.
Just weird, just freak. At 6 p.m, he called a friend in mock surprise, basically saying that someone had broken into the house and shot his family. Some reports I saw said that he went to a bar with friends and then returned to the same bar at 6 a.m. Basically came in.
Face, like,
yeah, like pretending like you didn't just murder them all. but apparently he said he returned to this bar at 6 a.m. saying, like, you've got to help me. I think my mother and father have been shot. Like, please come, someone help me. It's hard to get facts in this case just because so much has been twisted from the original story because of all the different film remakes and books about it. But either way, he alerted attention to the family stuff. So now we get into the investigation. So, spoiler alert, it doesn't take long for them to identify a suspect. Straight off the bat. So, police are phoned, they arrive in the scene. As you can imagine, it was completely horrifying. Six family members lying dead.
I'm pretty sure I've seen the pictures.
I've seen the pictures out on there. Horrific. Yeah. They're not... I mean, they're not that gory. There's quite a lot of blood, but just for the fact they're all just lying in the same position they were.
Like, prior?
Prior, just, like, asleep. Very, very weird. So, amongst the victims were obviously Ronald and Louise DeFeo and their four kids. And as I said, the youngest was only 9. Which is just
like, what did they do?
Yeah, like, fair enough, the dad, I can understand.
Yeah.
Not condoning it, but I can understand why.
It makes sense.
But like, why? Like, what did your 9-year-old brother do?
Your 9-year-old brother, your loving mother that spends all this money on you, loves you, like, unconditionally. Like, what?
Just something not right. The police noted straight away that something wasn't adding up with these murders. Something about the scene and the kind of timeline of the crimes just didn't make sense to them. The first thing was, obviously, there was no sign of a break-in, so the killer obviously had access from within the house. Now, remember, Ronald isn't considered a suspect at this point, so they're still weighing up options.
Okay.
There was maybe talk about this being like a mob killing or something to do with the mafia, that sort of thing. They also noted there was no signs of struggle present on any of the bodies or any evidence that they'd been drugged, and this was later confirmed by the autopsy. So none of the family members had any trace of alcohol or drugs in their system.
Okay.
Now, this is interesting when you think about, we got into the fact that there was no struggle, yet he was firing a shotgun point blank in a house. You'd think one of them would have woke up.
Yeah, that's...
And maybe went out to the hallway.
I didn't
even
think of that, like, surely, like...
We'll get into it more.
I'd shit myself, like...
We'll get into it more, but it's very weird how they were all just asleep during this moment.
Yeah, like, the last one, like, the last one to be shot surely would have woke up and be like...
Especially if he's going from, like, one floor to another, you have time to kind of wake up and be like, whoa, and, yeah. And what even weirder when we talk about the gunshots, no neighbours who were awake reported hearing any gunshots.
And it's fucking loud. I've heard the gunshot. It's, it's loud.
But apparently they heard the family's dog barking in the middle of the night.
Oh, so they heard a fucking dog bark?
Yeah, but they didn't hear a shotgun. And there was no silencer. The police have confirmed he didn't use a silencer. There was a shotgun as well, so very, very loud gun. We'll get onto that as well when they later test this crime scene. But right now, there's alarm bells kind of going off in the police's head. So Ronald was taken in. He was taken into protective custody because, as I said, there was a fear that this was like part of the mob, like a mob murder going on.
Mm-hmm.
So they took him. I saw in a documentary, the police took him to a nearby neighbour's house called Rufus Ireland. Ireland, yes. And they were using his house as like a sort of base during the investigation. And that's where Ronald was questioned about the whereabouts of himself at the nights of the murder. And that's kind of where he crumbled.
Mm-hmm.
So Ronald gave his alibi that he was at work and then he went to the bar. This immediately, the police were on his tail, because they knew that the family had been dead well before 6 a.m. They actually put the point of death at around 3:15.
Mm-hmm.
That's specific.
Like, yeah. 3:15.
And then this is when he started to change his story. He's changed his story several times throughout the full investigation and throughout the years of being in custody. At one point, he started to spin the story about how there was a mob hitman called Louis Fellini, and he said he killed his family and made Ronald watch the full thing. But Fellini had a solid out-of-state alibi, so he was ruled off straight away. And shortly after, he confessed to the police the truth that he was the one that killed his family.
Kicking the buzz, that would be like, try to blame someone, then they're like,
no, he wasn't even in the state, pal, like, try again. I mean, he tried his best.
Gold star.
Now, I'm going to say his alibi was assumed to be the truth. Okay. I'm going to take it with a pinch of salt, because we are going to get onto it after we cover the trial and his sentencing.
Mm-hmm.
There are theories that Ronald was accompanied by a second murderer who basically helped him. And when we look at different aspects of the crime, you'll see I'm more to toying with the idea that it was more than one killer.
I just don't get how no one woke up.
Yeah. Six people as well. And they estimated there was around 9 shots in total.
Like, you'd hear one shot and wake up, not like more than what, you know what I mean? Like,
especially when they're so close together as well, like boom, boom,
like
boom,
room to room, like the same. Sorry, I'm rambling, but
no, it's frustrating. So we'll get on to the trial now.
Okay,
Ronald DeFeo stood trial on October 14th, 1975. Now, his attorney was William Weber. Remember that name, because William he comes Weber. Into it in the second part of this.
I actually know that name.
So he mounted an insanity plea, basically stating that Ronald had heard voices that told him to kill his family, wasn't in the right mindset, he was probably suffering from like paranoid schizophrenia, all that. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this whole idea of him hearing voices is something that's very capitalised on when it comes to the book and the film retellings of this story. It's kind of the focal point, because it is that, you know, weird, demonic, paranormal idea of like dark voices telling you to kill your family. Okay, this is all bullshit. He recanted
bullshit.
He recanted it. He said it wasn't true. They were just trying to get an insanity plea, because with a crime like this, that's so gruesome and so, you know, out of the ordinary,
you want like a shorter...
It's your only chance of getting a shorter service sentence, like, at all, is saying that you're... Yep. So I'm going to play a clip from the defence attorney, William Weber, talking about what Ronald said in the stand had happened that night.
Okay.
And basically what made him kill his parents. Now, again, take this with a pinch of salt, because it was later recanted, but we'll have a wee listen.
Getting really high-tech here.
Weber decided on a plea of insanity. When he interviewed DeFeo about what he remembered happening on the night of the murders, a strange series of events was described that would prompt speculation about who was behind the killings.
Ronnie had taken some drugs. He was watching television, and there was a war picture on. And at the end of the picture, Ronnie was in the room alone. He said initially he thought that he heard members of his family in another room conspiring to kill him. The one thing that he said, and sometimes he said it with a smirk, so I wasn't sure if it was truthful, but he said that a female with black hands gave me the rifle, and I went ahead and shot everybody.
His original testimony was that at some point, a hooded, black-handed demon handed him a weapon, and that he went upstairs, and that he committed the murder. He said the murder, not the murders.
Yeah, so that was the story he spinned.
Creepy. Listen to that. Like the back.
The background noises, yeah. It's because it's from a documentary, so it's very dramatised. So yeah, his night of the events was that some hooded figure, first of all, he said he heard his family in another room conspire to kill him, and then a hooded figure handed him this rifle and compelled him to kill his parents.
That's so scary.
Oh. Interesting, because when he was later prompted after one interview he'd done whilst he was in jail, he claims that despite still being addicted to drugs and constantly using, he said he was sober this night, he wasn't on any drugs. But in this story, he says that he woke up from a drug-filled haze and this demon
handed him a gun.
Yeah. Remember that hooded figure?
Okay.
Because we're going to come back to it.
Oh, is this like a...
This is part of the
comeback character.
This is kind of part of the makes a debut in season 2. No, but it's part of the theory. So it is worth noting the court ruled out the insanity plea. They said he's completely sane. He was evaluated by court psychiatrists, who all found him completely sane. Furthermore, there was no paranormal activity or reports of paranormal activity in the house until after the murders.
Right.
And this is important when we get on to talk about George and Kathy Lutz and their role in the Amityville house and how that all came
and
about.
And if there's reports after all that happening, kind of makes it seem like bullshit as well, because there's people just being like, oh, it's hot, it's haunted.
Because there was a bad murder here and now it's haunted. Yeah. Sure. A psychiatrist who testified for the defence said that Defoe or Defeo had dissociative disorder, which meant that he would have experienced the murders as almost like an out-of-body experience. So he was watching it happen rather than experiencing himself actually committing them.
That's weird.
However, the psychiatrist testified for the prosecution successfully argued that DeFeo actually had antisocial personality disorder, which whilst he still had mental health issues, it would mean he was perfectly aware of what he was doing and he had a regard for right or wrong. So whilst he had mental health issues, they didn't affect his decision to kill his parents. Yeah. So the insanity defence was thrown out the window.
Right.
The prosecution argued that while the drug abusing DeFeo was indeed troubled, he knew what he was doing when he committed the murders, and a jury convicted him on 6 counts of second degree murder and sentenced him to 6 concurrent sentences of 25 years to life. So I think it was around about 150 years in total that he got, as he should, and he should rot in hell. What was that?
I don't know, I keep hearing like weird noises and it's starting to fucking creep me out.
It's a demon. Oh, don't say
is that. The hooded figure?
We've not even got into the paranormal stuff yet. We're already shitting yourself.
Oh, I hate it. I hate it.
I don't know. Anyway, let's move on.
Help.
So we touched on the fact that Ronald had changed his accounts of events from that night. He later changed his story, saying that his sister Dawn was the one that killed their father, and that the mother saw it and was so distraught and she killed all the siblings. And then he killed the mother and then killed Dawn. Which, I don't believe it, because as we said, they were all killed in their beds.
Yeah.
And it was proven that none of the bodies had been moved post-mortem. So I highly doubt that he managed to convince his mother and Dawn to lie down and then shot them. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, that doesn't...
Weird. In 1990, he then again claimed that his sister Dawn had done it. He claimed in this version of events that she killed the full family, and then he just killed her because of what she'd done to the family. Now, at this point, I think he's either trying to get a lesser sentence or he's at some desperate attempt to try and save his character. Because no one's going to believe you if you've changed your story so many times.
No, it's like, boy who cried wolf.
Yeah, it's just weird. He maintains that his lawyer, William Weber, pressured him into the insanity plea that they went
so
with the trial.
It's everyone else's fault, isn't it?
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised, because as I said, it's probably his best chance at getting a lesser sentence for a crime like this, especially. All his requests for parole have been denied, so he's not getting out anytime soon. So let's go into the theories. So there's two main theories surrounding many of the kind of unanswered questions in this case. The first one I've already mentioned is that there's more than one killer. And the second one is that the house is haunted, and that's what compelled Ronald to kill his family. I'm only going to talk about the first one in this episode because I want to keep it kind of true to the facts. And we'll leave the kind of paranormal discussion to the other episode, because that's what we're talking about in the second episode, the kind of haunted house aspect. So the double murder theory that's been suggested, this was first of all suggested by the police who first arrived in the scene. This was eventually dropped once Defoe or DeFeo confessed, because they had their killer in their eyes and they didn't really need to investigate it further. But I feel like they should have. So they considered the fact that maybe more than one person had been responsible for some of the murders, or he was helped or aided in some way. The new evidence for this was provided by Ryan, and I'm going to butcher this name, Katzenbach. Katzenbach. He released a documentary surrounding this whole theory in 2011. It's really good. You should watch it if anyone recommends anyone that's interested in the case. But he basically touches on this aspect of the crime scene, things not adding up.
No.
So, first of all, the time frame of the murders, very, very short, around 15 minutes.
Mm.
Now, it's not impossible for him to commit them if he's just going from room to room. But considering the size of the house and the loud noise of the gun,
mm-hmm.
it does add a little bit of suspicion. Police done a reconstruction of the crime scene. So they basically used the same type of gun that Ronald would have used.
Mm-hmm.
And they found that the noise that the gun made once you fired it would have been able to have been heard from 3 to 4 blocks away. Yeah, and this is in the house.
How is that not waking anyone up? How is neighbours not like, oh no. So
yeah, like you think, and this was a very quiet suburban neighborhood.
Yeah.
It wasn't as if a gunshot would just be like written
pure
off.
Posh nosy neighbors.
Yeah, like. So you think someone would phone up and be like, "I just had a gunshot from the Amityville house."
There would be
someone...
a Karen per house.
Yeah, like. Literally. Like this is the sort of neighborhood that like, neighborhood watch and stuff.
Yeah,
like you would get shunned if you didn't pick up your thugs droppings, like that sort.
Thugs droppings.
That kind of you know scene. Yeah. Also, it was a big 3-story house. So how were 6 different victims shot on 2 separate levels and no one heard the gunshots and no one got out of bed? 9 separate gunshots as well.
That's bullshit.
So
that's making me angry.
And the theory about the bodies being moved after the mm-hmm. murders mm-hmm. were thrown out the window because autopsy reports found that they hadn't. And furthermore, they weren't drugged or no alcohol was found in the bloodstream. So it's not as if he drugged them in their beds yeah. and then they all... Very, very weird. A team of underwater archaeologists shortly after the murders found a gun in a canal behind the house.
Mm-hmm.
This is interesting because after the killing, obviously police found the pillowcase that Roger had used to hide the rifle and other evidence. They found his handgun holster, but no gun.
Right.
So Katzenbach, the guy that did this documentary, he said that the missing gun is the one that the team put out of the canal. He said there was 2 guns in the crime scene, 1 gun and 1 gun holster.
Okay.
But the gun they found didn't fit in the holster, it belonged to another gun, which was the one that they found in the canal. So, interesting, just 2 guns that were tried to be disposed of.
Yeah.
Herman Reyes, who was a criminologist, he was hired by the defence and he basically told the judge and the prosecutor in like a closed courtroom, so there was no members of the public, no jury,
it was just.
He said that some of the bodies had been moved and not all the victims had been killed in the positions that they had been found in.
Uh-huh.
And he also believed that more than 1 high-powered rifle was used for the killing due to the kind of ballistic tests on the victims the gunshot wounds found. This wasn't used in the case. It didn't affect the case.
Why?
I don't know. Maybe it was just because there wasn't enough evidence.
What?
Or maybe the autopsy technician... who had originally viewed the body had ruled it out and said, well, no, this is my expert opinion. Very, very weird.
Strange.
So, a lot of people who believe in this theory think that the accomplice was his 18-year-old sister, Dawn. Okay?
Okay.
Family and friends recanted that they had a special bond, and some or even don't. Go as far to suggest a relationship of an incestuous nature.
And they theorised
that because of this, they had plotted to kill the parents together. To be together, or whatever way. That's kind of the suggested theory. So, when he was changing his story and started naming her, maybe there was a little bit of truth to it. Maybe he was trying to protect her, but I don't know why, because she was dead. I don't know why, but yeah. It still doesn't explain how he killed her and how she was found in the exact same position as the rest of the family members.
Mm-hmm.
Unless, if she was armed as well, like you think she would be able to just be like, unless he took the gun off her and, I don't know, force her at gunpoint to lie down in a specific position and then kill her. But I don't really see that happening.
No.
What? Other interesting things about this theory is 2 aspects of Dawn's death differ from the rest of her family.
Mm-hmm.
Her killing was the most brutal by far. Her head was... basically almost obliterated by the shotgun blast. There was also reports that her nightgown had unburnt gunpowder on it, which would suggest that she fired a gun that night because she had gunpowder residue on her nightdress. But her hands were never tested for gunpowder residue.
Why?
Because I think at this point they thought at least they had an open and shut case. He confessed to the murders. They had the guy behind bars. They didn't need to investigate it further.
They should though.
And she was dead anyway, so nothing would have came about it. So waste of police time and resources. But
The people want answers.
People want to know, and this is something that's been theorized for years now. I think it was after the whole Amityville horror thing came out, but I mean, still. And it's a bit too late now because they're dead and their bodies probably couldn't be exhumed at this point. Now, we're getting on to back to the hooded figure.
Oh, great.
So if you remember Ronald's story about the hooded woman handing him a gun before he killed his family.
Mm-hmm.
A few years after the trial and after Ronald had been incarcerated, a journalist called Rick Moran came out with a story. So basically he was contacted by a drug enforcement agent, and basically this agent had told him that he was surveying the DeFeo home at mm-hmm. the time, mm-hmm. most likely due to Ronald's drug use.
Yeah.
And he says on the night of the murder he was outside the house surveying it, and he saw the sister Dawn leaving the house wearing a dark jacket and gloves with her rifle. And he said that she got in the car and drove to a dock, which is where the weapon was later found. The second gun was later found. This was never brought to court, but it was
obviously the
case was closed at this point. And despite this, Ronald is widely accepted as acting alone in his family murders. So he's on paper anyway seen as the murderer. He's still alive. He's 68, and he's currently been held at the Sullivan Correctional Facility in the town of Fallsburg, New York. All of his appeals and all of his requests have been denied by the parole board. So he's probably going to be in there for the rest of his life, as he should.
Yeah. I mean, he's not got that long left. So.
I mean, he's 68. I mean, people don't really live to that long in prison.
No.
He's rotting away for the rest of his life. Good. And as he should, because this whole case is really, really sad. But, that was the Amityville murders. Very creepy, very puzzling case.
It's just angered me.
It's angered me as well. When I was researching it, I was like, there's so many dead ends, they could have just digged a little bit further.
Yeah.
But that was the first part. That was the key. That's what happened in the home.
Mm-hmm.
Part two, we're going to be talking about George and Kathy Lutz, who are very much credited in the Amityville we know now in mm-hmm. popular culture mm-hmm. and how it's kind of this paranormal, haunted place.
Mm.
But it's important to kind of remember that these killings were, like, became famous. Obviously, a guy shoots his whole family in his house while they're sleeping. And this made news, so there is a kind of speculation whether they saw that and then capitalised on the fact.
I was going to say that. I feel like
mm-hmm.
people are... And it's such a sad story as well. I feel like it's just so horrible that people are just, like, profiting off of...
Yeah. Jumping on the bandwagon.
Like a family's death.
Mm-hmm. But we'll get into that and the controversy that surrounds that couple, because mm-hmm. there is a lot of lawsuits, a lot of public outcry.
Yeah.
But for now, I think we'll leave it there and join us for part two in the Amityville Horror House case.
Ooh.
And we'll see you in the next episode. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for... I swear too much. I'm sorry, guys.
It's fine. I swear all the time. It's cool. When you're talking about murder and...
Yeah.
All that stuff. But we will talk to you in part two. Bye bye.
Bye.
You're like, bye.
Bye. Welcome to the panic room, where all your darkest fears are gonna come for you.